scale to the next chapter. I have this audio. This, okay, every time it does the somewhere, sometime, the little boy had been lost in the woods for longer than he could remember. That's the same text every time, right? And until it, like, resolves, right? Yeah, I was on, okay, yeah, I already have that. I'm gonna copy and paste that every time. Chapter 9. Reactions and Overreactions, Part 2. Somewhere, sometime. Years in the future, but not many. Okay. A heavily warded and reinforced chamber deep beneath the Temple of Wisdom in Shambhala. 6:42 a.m. local time. Remus Lupin, Brother Chandra to most of his peers at the temple, awoke with a loud and painful gasp of air before looking around wildly to find himself nude and alone in a cold, darkened chamber. He gave a relaxed sigh. All was as it should be. Yeah. All was as it should be. Then he arose and moved to the locked door, stepping gingerly over the stripped carcass of a yak which had been provided by the monks and upon which his other half had dined heartily in the night. At the door, he closed his eyes and spent several seconds waving his hands in a complicated mudra that would have been beyond either the dexterity or the wisdom of a werewolf. The door clicked open, and Remus Lupin stepped through to the lighted... antechamber where his clothes and wand were waiting. Naturally, the Alohomora charm would have been faster and easier, but the risk of leaving his wand where it might be smashed by an anger-crazed werewolf was too great. The English monk calmly dressed himself and then stepped back to his holding cell to vanish the yak's remains and scourgify the cell. He made a mental note to spend time meditating in gratitude to the spirit of the animal for its self-sacrifice on behalf of his own mental health. He also made a mental note to gargle as soon as possible to get the taste of yak meat out of his mouth. At this point on his spiritual journey, Remus only ate meat while in the throes of his lycan. Remus only ate meat while in the throes of his lycanthropic transformation, and he had grown to otherwise dislike the taste of it, especially when it was still raw and bloody. However, years of study had... years of study had shown that if the beast was allowed to slake its hunger for flesh on a sufficient quantity of animal flesh, it was less likely to take... It was less likely to take out its anger at confinement on its own physical body, and the taste of yak breath was a small price to pay not to wake up half-dead and covered in scratches and claw marks. Indeed, except for the intense recurring nightmare that came with every transformation just before you... Except for the intense recurring nightmare that came with every transformation just before he woke the next morning, Remus considered his transformations almost consequence-free. From his transformation chamber, Remus climbed the many stairs up to his own rooms, bowing respectfully to all the other monks who crossed his path, all of whom returned the bow with equal respect. Back in his private chambers, Remus took a quick cold shower and dressed in fresh clothes. When he returns to his sitting room, there was a small tray waiting on his table containing fresh fruit, rice, fish broth, and juice, along with a folded copy of the Daily Prophet. Remus smiled. In all his time in Shambhala, he had never actually seen a house elf here, but he knew the temple had... Unlike the elves back in Britain, however, the house elves of Shambhala were almost never seen in physical form, preferring to perform their duties silently and invisibly. The wizard sat at his table, popped a peach slice into his mouth, and opened the paper, only to spit out the fruit after nearly choking on it.
Death Eaters escape from Azkaban. Sirius Black, Bellatrix Lestrange,
The Lestrange brothers, Augustus Rookwood, you know who's in Tyre in a circle. Who will save us from the Death Eater menace? I'll probably just grab the audio from almost the end of two chapters ago. Check something. Carl Urban, that's right, Carl Urban. I kept forgetting that. I did know that, but I completely forgot. Yeah. Let me also. There we go. Okay. Nearly in shock, Remus tore through the article. Sirius? Free? He whispered to himself in a flurry of mixed emotions. And if the betrayer was free, it was a safe bet he might try to pick up where his master had left off. Remus shook his head. It seemed that Jim's training could no longer be left off until the following summer, just as it seemed that Remus's reunion with young Harry could no longer be delayed. He reached for his wand. "Expecto Patronum," he intoned, and a beautiful silver wolf appeared at his side. Gutta Hila Basker and the High Lama, tell each of them that I humbly but urgently request an audience with them both as soon as their schedules allow. The wolf nodded and then disappeared. Remus swiftly moved to a writing desk, from which he withdrew some parchment and a quill that hadn't been used in years. To Albus Dumbledore, Headmaster, Hogwarts School for Witchcraft and Wizardry.
I do this every time, Theo, you fuck off.
Theo, do you know if you'll be able to rubber duck me in clan? I don't know if you have the proper experience. Check clan.
Anyway, okay.
4 August, 1993. The Weasley Burrow. Noon.
And Theo, full information hygiene on this. Absolutely no hint.
Okay, yeah, you got that, yeah. Okay.
After a busy morning of denoming the garden, the five youngest Weasley children entered the burrow for lunch. Percy stopped to turn on the wizarding wireless just in time for the noon news broadcast. Percy stopped to turn on the wizarding wireless just in time for the noon news broadcast.
Percy, Molly scolded gently, we don't listen to the wireless at the dinner table.
I'm not listening for music, Mum, the boy replied. There's supposed to be a news update about the Wizengamot hearing.
Yeah, said Fred with a laugh. Maybe Dad will get to give a speech.
I'll behave, Fred. Molly said with some irritation. This is a very important meeting, and it's a great honour for your father to be there among the Order of Merlinholders.
Before she could say any more, the music on the wireless faded away to be replaced by the dulcet tones of the lunchtime newsreader for the Wizarding Wireless.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Wait. Okay.
What gender is this person?
because the name is Alchemy. Also, how the fuck do you say Alchemy? I have a distinct newsreader voice for a male and female newsreader. You are so fucking droll. Okay.
Good afternoon, Wizards. Yeah. Good afternoon, witches and wizards. This is Alchemy Doodle. This is Alchemy. No, it's not. This is Alchemy Doolittle with the 12 o'clock news. It has been 4 days since the daring jailbreak from Azkaban that has riveted the entire nation. Thus far, the DMLE has no leads on the fugitive Death Eaters.
No.
Thus far, the DMLE has no leads on the fugitive Death Eaters, which includes Sirius Black, Rabastan and Rodolphus Lestrange, Bellatrix Black Lestrange, and Augustus Rookwood. Should any of our listeners have any information on the whereabouts of the escapees or the unknown individuals responsible for their escape, we urge you to contact the DMLE at once. For the moment, the DMLE advises that Magical Britain's threat level is rated as Red Severe. The Wizard Gambit is currently in recess for lunch and will resume deliberations at 2 o'clock. This morning's session was brief but contentious. After the calling of the rolls and the ceremonial renewal of the vows of unity, the reports of the DMLE and the Aurora Corps regarding the escape were presented, followed by a brief but spirited question and answer period. DMLE Director Amelia Bones began the report by officially clearing Minister Fudge, Chief Aurora Potter, and Aurora Michael Proudfoot of any involvement in the escape. Immediately thereafter, a point of order was raised by Lord Yaxley as to whether Polyjuice Potion was used, and if so, whether it spoke to a failure of security on the part of the DMLE that hair samples from such illustrious personages could be obtained so easily by enemies of the state. Approximately 1 hour earlier. James stiffened slightly at the implied rebuke from Yaxley, a man he was almost certain was an unmarked Death Eater.
Oh, fuck with the Welsh. It's an ongoing process, isn't it?
A preliminary investigation indicates that the three intruders responsible for the breakout maintained their forms after at least 2 hours and two separate exposures to thieves' downfall, James said, referring to the report on the table in front of him. This would seem to exclude the use of Polyjuice Potion. Accordingly...
No, that was too... That was Indian. Why does it go Indian? I mean, that's not a phenomenon that's limited to me, by the way. Had it for a while, and now it's gone again. Let's try it again.
Our preliminary investigation indicates that the three intruders responsible for the breakout maintained their forms after at least 2 hours and two separate exposures to thieves' downfall, James said, referring to the report on the table in front of him. This would seem to exclude the use of Polyjuice Potion. Accordingly, we are proceeding under the assumption that the intruders were a trio of Metamorphmagi.
That's decent. That's getting there. I need to get some scratch together and,
Up in the gallery, Harry's brow furrowed.
While it was to the benefit of Regulus's conspiracy, he was surprised that the DMLE had dismissed the possibility of an improved... He was surprised that the DMLE had dismissed the possibility of an improved polyjuice so completely. Then he realized that they probably hadn't... Then he realized that they probably hadn't dismissed it at all, but were simply downplaying that possibility to prevent panic. Better the nation think that there were three rogue shapeshifters than a possible army of them that were immune to detection. Better the nation think that there were three rogue shapeshifters than a possible army of them that were immune to detection.
"Chief Warlock, I rise to a point of inquiry," said the venerable Griselda Marchbanks. The ancient witch rose stiffly to her feet as she was recognized by the Chief Warlock. "I was given to understand, Lord Potter, that there is only one known metamorph magus in all of magical Britain, a young woman currently studying at the Aura Academy. Has she been investigated in connection with these monstrous acts?"
"She has, Lady Marchbanks. At the time of the prison break, she was at home with her parents in Hogsmeade."
Then James took a deep breath as Tiberius Knott rose as well. Up in the gallery, Harry's eyes flashed angrily before his mask of perfect calm slipped back into place.
"I also rise to a point of inquiry, Chief Warlock."
There was a slight but noticeable hesitation before Dumbledore recognized the man who then turned his attention to the Chief Auror.
"Lord Potter, am I correct in assuming that the young metamorph magus of whom you speak is one Nymphadora Tonks, the daughter of Andromeda Tonks, formerly of House Black, specifically the sister of one of the escapees, the cousin of another, and the sister-in-law of two more?"
And there was a burst of excited whispers from the assembled peers at the invocation of the ancient and noble House of Black, whose seat was currently vacant. From the Chief Warlock's desk, Dumbledore banged his gavel for order.
"And furthermore..."
Oh, this... I thought that was Yaxley. That was fucking Yaxley's voice. Let me redo that.
"I also rise to a point of inquiry, Chief Warlock."
There was a slight but noticeable hesitation before Dumbledore recognized the man who then turned his attention to the Chief Auror.
"Lord Potter, am I correct in assuming that the young metamorph magus of whom you speak is one Nymphadora Tonks, the daughter of Andromeda Tonks, formerly of House Black, specifically the sister of one of the escapees, the cousin of another, and the sister-in-law of two more?"
There was a burst of excited whispers from the assembled peers at the invocation of the ancient and noble House of Black, whose seat was currently vacant. From the Chief Warlock's desk, Dumbledore banged his gavel for order.
"And furthermore," Knott continued, "am I not also correct in my understanding that this is the same Andromeda Tonks who currently provides sanctuary to the outcast known as Theo No Name?"
That announcement led to even louder commentary and even a few gasps until Dumbledore banged his gavel again, and with perhaps more force than tradition allowed.
"The point of inquiry is ruled out of order, Lord Knott," he said firmly and with a hint of coldness.
"Whatever else he may be, Theodore No Name is a child of only 13 years, and his current housing arrangements are not relevant to this discussion. Likewise, Andromeda Tonks has never been accused or even suspected of any criminal acts against the state or the people of magical Britain, and she is in fact a well-regarded member of the Hogsmeade community with a sterling reputation. The Wizengamot does not adjudicate guilt or innocence on the basis of family history, Lord Knott, as I'm sure you recall.
Tiberius's eye twitched slightly.
I withdraw the point of inquiry, Chief Warlock, he said tersely before sitting back down. Then it was Lord Macmillan's turn to be recognized. Harry knew little about the Macmillans. The Macmillan heir was a Gryffindor who had graduated during... There. The Macmillan heir was a Gryffindor who had graduated during Harry's first year. He vaguely recalled that the younger son, Ernie, was in his year, but the boy was a Hufflepuff, and Harry was sure they'd never spoken for more than a few minutes. That's a kilogram of steel. Kilogram of steel. Okay. Chief Warlock. Chief Warlock, I rise to a point of order. Director Bones, setting aside the Tonks girl, that still leaves at least two other Metamorph Magi involved in the attack on Azkaban. If there are no other known Metamorph Magi in Wizarding Britain, what consideration is the DMLE given to the possibility of foreign agents being responsible for the attack?
That's decent.
Director Bones replied,
The DMLE is considering all avenues of investigation, Lord Macmillan. That said, at this time, we cannot exclude the possibility of... We cannot exclude the possibility of involvement by foreign wizards or... We cannot exclude the possibility of involvement by foreign wizards and even foreign governments. Though we as yet have no idea as to any possible motive for a foreign wizard... Though we as yet have no idea as to any possible motive for a foreign wizarding government to free Death Eaters from Azkaban prison. For a foreign wizarding government to free Death Eaters from Azkaban prison.
From across the room, Lord Parkinson, Pansy's father, gave a loud snort of laughter.
With all due respect, Director Bones, I think that bespeaks of a lack of imagination on the part of the DMLE.
Director Bones did not rise to the insult, though her expression made her feelings about Parkinson clear. Dumbledore apparently felt the same, as he ruled the comment out of order and chastised Parkinson for speaking without being recognized. Then, to Harry's surprise, Peter Pettigrew stood up from the Potter seat to make his own point of order. Dumbledore glanced down at James for a fraction of a second before recognizing the Potter Seneschal.
With respect to my learned colleagues, Pettigrew said, I believe it is premature to speculate wildly on the nature of the threat we face when the investigation has only begun.
Certainly we discredit ourselves and this institution if we frighten the wizarding populace with groundless insinuations about foreign invaders working alongside Death Eaters. With that in mind, perhaps it will be best to move on to another matter. Lord Potter, a point of inquiry. Regardless of how the intruders gained access to Azkaban, whether metamorph magic or other means, does your investigation have any leads on how they were able to escape from Azkaban?
James rose to respond almost as soon as Peter started speaking. After a second, Harry nodded to himself in understanding. He felt quite sure that Peter had asked his question in response to some discreet signal from James in order to divert attention away from something James didn't want to discuss at the moment, most likely something to do with the international implications of the jailbreak. Idly, he wondered which of the two came up with the stratagem. Probably Pettigrew, he thought. Or maybe even Dumbledore.
We do have some leads, said the Chief Auror. It appears that the intruders have access to some kind of advanced portkey method, one capable of penetrating the anti-portkey walls of Azkaban Prison. Accordingly, we have instituted a crackdown on the illegal manufacture and sale of portkeys by unlicensed distributors. After that pronouncement that the possibly foreign shapeshifting inv- ah.
After that pronouncement, that the possibly foreign shapeshifting invaders had access to portkeys seemingly able to slice through some of the most powerful wards ever devised, it took quite a lot of gavel banging before order was restored. And that'll be it for today, guys. I'll try and finish this chapter next time.
Jump in the night, lock your body in time. Okay, I believe you. Rock your body in time.
Okay.
One hour later. Although much concern was expressed over the possibility of portkeys capable of circumventing anti-portkey wards, Director Burns and Chief Orapont were quick to address fears that such portkeys could be used to penetrate wards on public facilities or private homes. As Director Burns noted, the intrusion into Azkaban Prison required a daring use of shapeshifters to penetrate the prison security and remain undiscovered for several hours. This, she said, strongly implied that it was not possible to simply portkey into a warded area, and that the advanced portkey simply allowed one to, as Lord Potter phrased it, blast their way out. After the reports were submitted and approved, the Wizard Gambit...
Fuck me.
The Wizard Gambit adjourned for 2 hours. When the session resumes this afternoon, it will begin deliberations on how to respond to this terrorist event, including a review of Minister Fudge's controversial proposal to reinstitute... Including a review of Minister Fudge's controversial proposal to reinstitute the Death Eater laws, which had previously been repealed in 1981. For the Wizarding Wireless News, I'm Mark Minnie Doolittle. George Weasley stared wide-eyed at the Wizarding Wireless for a long moment before heading quickly to the stairs. George, where are
you going?
What the fuck is wrong with me today?
George, where are you going? Molly asked. We're about to start lunch.
The boy looked back at her and Molly was shocked at his gaunt expression.
I'm not feeling very well, Mum. I think I'll go lie down for a bit if that's okay.
Then without waiting for an answer, he practically ran up the stairs. Concerned, Molly started to follow him when Arthur called her name from the flue. As she went to speak with her husband, Percy looked over to Fred and jerked his head in the direction of the stairs. A moment later, Fred entered the room he shared with his twin, with Percy close behind.
Right, George, what's going on?
Fred's voice faded away as he took in George's ashen face. The boy was sitting on his bed and staring forlornly at the floor, and he looked like he was on the verge of either bursting into tears or vomiting. Percy moved past Fred to sit next to George. He put his arm on the frightened boy's shoulder.
George, he said in a gentle voice, whatever it is, it'll be okay. Just talk to me.
George finally looked up at his brothers.
It's my fault.
The Bangars have staged the prison break. They used my portkey design to break out. I'm a part of all of this. Fred snorted softly.
Pull the other one, George. I'm serious, he exclaimed angrily.
Look, don't you two get it? One of the people who broke into Azkaban was disguised as Aura Proudfoot. The same Aura Proudfoot who showed up here to collect my portkey notes, and then warned all of us not to talk about it with anyone. We had a Death Eater in our house. And he was alone with Mumba part of the time. Who knows what he might have done if I hadn't just handed over all my notes like an idiot.
So you think there's a connection between Professor Lockhart's research projects and the Azkaban breakout? Percy asked in a soft voice.
There's got to be, George replied. And then, to his surprise, Percy let out a short, slightly hysterical bark of laughter.
What's so funny?
My voice slightly cracked in that, but I actually like that read. Percy shook his head and turned to George.
Well, look on the bright side, George. At least you're not the only Weasley to have been an unwitting accomplice.
Huh?
Fred asked in confusion. Percy looked back and forth between the two twins as he explained.
The day before Lockhart took a runner from Hogwarts.
That's incorrect.
The day before Lockhart did a runner from Hogwarts, I turned in my final project for Team Chameleon, the research team working on Polyjuice Potion. My paper was about a theoretical way to extend Polyjuice's duration. It wasn't a particularly safe modification, as it would probably make you quite sick once the transformation wore off, but if the research we all did for Lockhart was used by the people who staged the jailbreak, I reckon I'm as much of an accomplice as you. He snorted softly.
I guess there goes that ministry job for sure. Fred just shook his head.
It's your own fault, both of you. You could have just been lazy underachievers like me and just spent the whole year running laps around the castle, but no.
By the way, this is extremely funny. After I'm gonna be helping out a friend of mine with she just moved to England and she's like rebuilding her audio setup. She's a voice actor, and I was like, yeah, I can call you right after I do this recording session. Take like an hour. You can listen in if you want. She's like, oh sure. And so I linked her to the Discord server. She's like, oh sorry, I'm on too many Discord servers, and even then my iPad needs to charge, so I can't. Like, oh, that's why she's like, you have a Discord server for this fan fiction, an entire Discord server. And I'm like, well, it's not mine, it's the author's, and it's massive. And I sort of like, there's a whole part of Harry Potter Discord. Like, this Harry Potter Discord is a fucking thing. It was very funny. Anyway, right.
Florian Fortescue's Ice Cream Parlor. 1 o'clock p.m.
I'm surprised you weren't there this morning, Harry Potter said somewhat mischievously to his twin. I'd have figured out that our parents would want to show you off at Wizengamot sessions whenever possible.
And normally you'd be right, Jim replied somewhat ruefully before taking another drag on his milkshake. I haven't had to go since I started at Hogwarts, since regular sessions happen while we're at school, but before then, I occasionally got dragged to them for special occasions. And if you think an hour or so just taking roll was boring this morning, imagine having to listen to it when you're 7, and a mother has stuffed you into formal children's robes. Luckily, Mum and Dad's paranoia about Death Eater follow-up attacks against the Wizengamot meant I got to sleep in this morning.
The two boys had a table to themselves at Fortescue's while their parents sat at a separate nearby table along with Artie Podmore. As they talked and drank their milkshakes, the two tried to politely ignore the two Aurors stationed nearby as their bodyguards.
So, do you actually enjoy all that political stuff? Jim continued.
Enjoyment has nothing to do with it, Harry said. Politics is part of being a Potter, and if we don't work at it, we'll just be ceding more power to the bad guys.
I thought I was supposed to fight the bad guys while you did the boring stuff, Jim said, recalling their very first conversation on the day the Potters collected Harry from Privet Drive. Harry laughed. That conversation seemed so long ago. He'd been so ready to hate Jim, and for a while, Jim seemed eager to return his hatred. He was glad they seemed to have gotten past all their prior hostility. Of course, he still wasn't ready to forgive James and Lily by any means, and certainly not to the point of giving them the power to interfere with his life again. But if James and Artie could work out an arrangement to guarantee Harry's status, safety, and independence, maybe.
We're both Potters, Jim.
I think we'll both end up fighting the bad guys in our own different ways. He lifted up his own milkshake. To fighting the bad guys, he said as a toast. Jim chuckled and raised his own glass to clink against Harry's. And speaking of bad guys, what do you think about the jailbreak? Jim asked. Harry shrugged and then launched into the answer he'd prepared before the jailbreak had even happened. Honestly, I'm trying not to think about it. I'm confident that the Aurors will get the escapees caught and locked up. If not, it's because the escapees are already out of Britain, which means there won't be any immediate threat to us anyway. I'm taking too many classes this year to spend any spare time worrying about former Death Eaters who are probably too emaciated and insane to be a threat to anyone. Yeah, but if Voldemort is summoning his followers... Both boys took a second to smirk at the horrified gasps from their bodyguards, who were apparently still too afraid to say the Dark Lord's name. Then we'll deal with it when the time comes. But you and I are students. It's not our job to obsess over what Voldemort, gasp, might be doing. If it comes to that, you'll take him down, and I'll be right there with you. But for the time being, I'm more worried about ancient runes and arithmancy. Jim shuddered. Ugh. I think I'd rather fight Death Eaters. What are you taking for... What are you taking for electives? Divination and care of magical creatures. Easy outstandings. Harry snorted. I'll see you in Care of Magical Creatures, but divination? Just for an easy O? Not just for an easy O, Jim replied. I am the subject of a true prophecy, if you'll recall. I think maybe it would be a good idea for me to learn about how these things work. And also it's an easy O. Yes, and also it's an easy O. The twins both laughed.
Okay. I recently got some more help with Welsh. Anyone that's planning on coming to the recording on Friday for When the Roses Bloom Again, I've already recorded all of Travis Potter's lines for that. A friend of mine helped me with that. I really did decide to grit my teeth and make all the Potters Welsh. We're just going to blunder through for now.
So you think there's a chance of finally getting all of this resolved?
Maybe I can do it without my throat doing something funny.
So you think there's a chance of finally getting all of this resolved? James asked hopefully. Artie hesitated. His client had authorized him to discuss possibly resolving the conflict between Harry and his... His client had authorized him to discuss possibly resolving the conflict between Harry and his family, but the solicitor was confused. On one hand, he thought it would be good for Harry to develop a positive relationship with his parents if it was feasible. On the other, he was not yet persuaded that James and Lily Potter would do right by their son and heir. He had finally figured out Lily's position. She did care for Harry, but she felt certain that his life would be in continual danger if he stayed close to Jim. That much was clear from how she continually looked over at the table where the boys sat together chatting and eating... ice cream, as if she feared that Death Eaters would burst in at any second to claim both boys, despite the presence of two plainclothes Aurors just one table away. Her desire for reconciliation was tempered by her barely concealed...
Her desire for reconciliation was tempered by her barely concealed wish to relocate Harry to the Antipodes to be instructed by trusted tutors in a bunker protected by the Fidelius charm. Even if that meant he never saw the rest of his family again. James was harder to figure out. At first, back during Harry's first year, Artie had assumed that Lord Potter was simply biased in favor of the boy who lived, and also hopelessly prejudiced against Slytherins. Now, though, he was certain that James's motivations were more complicated, but Artie...
Kill me.
But Artie still couldn't begin to fathom why he would be so upset at having an heir as formidable as Harry, no matter what house he was in. I certainly hope so, Lord Potter, he finally said. But at a minimum, it will be contingent on Harry feeling assured that his heir status won't be compromised at any point. Why is he so afraid of that?
Nah, shit. Bullshit. Fucking terrible.
Why is he so afraid of that? James asked. Artie grimaced. Lord Potter. Harry is aware of the fact that you tried to disinherit him back in 1982. Lily's head jerked around, and she glared at James in reproachful surprise. James! It's not like that, Lily. This was years and years ago. Right after we sent Harry away. He turns to Artie. At the time, everyone assured us that Harry was a squib, but he would still be the legal heir until he was officially identified as such. And that wouldn't have happened until he was 11. At that time...
Hang on.
At the time, the war was still just winding down. And I was a young patrol officer.
No, not officer. Auror. Fuck me.
And I was a young patrol auror. A very hazardous job. If I had died, House Potter would have needed a regent until Harry... Until Harry either showed magic or failed to get the Hogwarts letter. And I'm sorry, Lily, but I don't think the Wizengamot would have approved a Muggle-born regent for an ancient and noble house. And Merlin... And Merlin only knows who they'd have appointed in your place. In fact, at the time, I think my closest pureblood relative was Narcissa Black Malfoy. But because Jim had already shown powerful magic, if he were the heir when I died, Peter could have gotten him Lord Conditional status, and then you could have held his regency no matter what any of the purebloods thought about it.
I think that was decent.
He sighed heavily. And anyway, I never even got past the initial stages before Peter and I concluded that we couldn't take Harry's heir status without revealing his existence and where he was staying to the general... And where he was staying to the general public, thereby endangering his life. At that point, I dropped the idea completely.
That's not really good enough, but I'm just gonna keep plunging on. Need to watch a fuckload of Gavin and Stacey, I really do.
I am sympathetic to the situation you were in at the time, Lord Potter, Artie said. But you must understand how all this looks to the boy. He has every reason to be distrustful to your intentions towards him. And if you truly want a reconciliation, you're going to have to give him assurances. Assurances that, according to my prior conversations with Miss Pettigrew, you have not been inclined to make. Peter has a tendency to be overprotective where Jim is concerned, Lily said diplomatically. This is one of those areas where maybe there's a conflict between his role as Seneschal and his role as Jim's godfather. That's why we wanted to talk to you for once without his input. Artie absorbed that information while idly stirring his now melted ice cream. Interesting. So Mrs. Potter is concerned that Pettigrew's fondness for Jim is clouding his judgment where Harry is concerned. Then he frowned at his ice cream. You know,
I can honestly say that I've never held a negotiation at an ice cream parlor before. It's oddly discomforting. I've had a few in the private dining room as at Summer Isles, but never at Fortescue's. James laughed. Lily hates Summer Isles for some reason. I've tried to get her to try it, but she refuses to set foot inside. Lily's...
Damn it.
Lily stiffened. I've tried it, James. It's just, well, I had an unpleasant dying experience there once, and I don't care to be reminded of it. But then, despite herself, Lily looked across Diagon Alley towards the famous Wizarding restaurant and frowned. It had indeed been a very unpleasant dining experience. Summer Isles.
Maybe someone else thing in my fucking throat this time.
Summer Isles. 25 July, 1976. The young Muggle-born girl sat nervously at her table waiting for her luncheon companion. Although she was in her best dress, she was acutely aware of how her Muggle attire made her stick out against the wealthy magicals in the restaurant in their fine robes and elaborate pointy hats. None of them appeared to pay her any mind, but she assumed at least some of them were whispering mudblood under their breath. Finally, after what seemed like an eternity, a figure moved past her and slid into the chair opposite.
Doria's a Black, right? It's Doria Black Potter, yes? Okay, so she doesn't have to be Wells too. Okay, good. No! Fuck you! Go fuck yourself. Skigo, I have a random question for you. You said that I've massively improved since early recording sessions of POS in terms of, like, how many mistakes I make and shit. Is that improvement, like... Does that improvement maintain when I am recording POS? Because I feel like it backslides some when I go back to POS. It might just be... I'm thinking it might just be a quirk of the writing style.
Oh, thank you, Zayas. It's very
good to hear. I've gotten... I've had two models for Welsh so far. One of them was a light Welsh, which was instructive, authentic, and not, you know, like that was enough to carry me through, like, re-recording James's dialogue for book one. But what I got help with, the person I got help with from for Charles in Lee's fic, was someone, a friend of mine who is not Welsh, but he is married to a Welsh woman, has Welsh in-laws, and has done a Welsh accent professionally before in, like, an audiobook for a Welsh client. And his wife doesn't speak with enough of an accent for her to just model for me. I mean, she's busy anyway, but it's not there enough. I can tell she's Welsh because I know she's Welsh, you know? but I wouldn't be able to use her as like, oh, here's how the accent works sort of thing. But he was helping me yesterday or the day before or something, and, like, very, very helpfully going over, like the things, like, when he recorded the lines for me, and what he was focusing on was the way the vowels work, the way that, like the rhythmic nature of it, the way that sort of the sounds move past each other in that particular Welsh manner. We were talking about that a lot. We chat about accents a lot. But yeah, like, I'm I'm going to see if I can maybe rail on him to do a little more for me, and then maybe I can get even better at it, because it was it was very, very helpful. It's such a, and as I always say, it's one of the hardest accents to do for many reasons, but one of those reasons is that it is so fucking easy to slip into a racist Indian accent. It's so easy. It's the easiest thing in the fucking world. Because a lot of the consonants and even some of the vowels are similar, and it's a fucking pain in the ass when you're Texas trying to do it. It is. It's easy to slip from, if you're American, you're trying to do a Welsh accent, it's easier to accidentally slip into a racist Indian accent. You guys have heard me do it before. Sure, like that, I guess. Yeah, I heard that recently, and it made me feel a whole lot better about myself. I was like, how is it just me? Like, cause like, I know that I'm very much on record here that I cannot yet do a decent Indian accent. I'm gonna have to for Paas, but like in a crack fic I was. By the way, guys, check out my Patreon. Siki, could you please link my Patreon? One of my patrons who assigns me crack fics to read. like a Naga king came up in a late chapter of a fic that a crack fic I finished recently, and he is described in the text as having a thick Indian accent. I just declined to do one. I was like, no, I'm not going to, because I can't yet. One of these days I will, but I'm not. I don't do accents that I don't think I can do, you know, unoffensively, and I don't see a whole, like, yeah, there was the famous India session for Paas where I got, like, 15 to 20 Indian dudes from this server together at, like, midnight my time, and I tried to get through one fucking line of dialogue that Bhaskar Gupta speaks, and I couldn't do it, and so we ended up just talking about, like, maybe some alternatives for a while. Yeah, and it's like I'm, you know, I still feel so fucking bad about this. I got a guy to model it for me, model all of Bhaskar Gupta's. I know. Skiko, I don't disagree with you. I just haven't gotten the time to try it again yet. Like that's. I do not disagree with that at all. I just need to find a block of time to do it. But a guy recorded all of Bhaskar Gupta's lines for me, and he did comment. He was nice about it, but he did comment. He was like, "Wow, this is a lot of work. I don't know how you do this. You know, like, man, this is taking me a while. Oh man," and I couldn't use what he gave me, and it wasn't his fault. I just couldn't do the voice that he had. Without it coming out sounding like a poo. I couldn't. And I tried. And so we ended up talking about, like, there's this one politician who has, like, Indians will probably know what I'm talking about. There's this accent. There's a very, very posh accent in India that is essentially British received pronunciation with a slight Indian twist on it. That like very, very wealthy people do, like sometimes do have in India. And I think I can probably get that one done. And that's what I'm going to end up doing for Gupta. Cause like otherwise, you know, I can't do fucking. Yeah, it would too as well. Like, and well, the guy that was the recorded lines originally, we figured out like where he was from, and it would also have made sense for him to have that accent as well. Like, you could make the argument that Gupta could be from any of those places, but it would make sense for him to sound posh. I can never remember the name of the politician, but anyway. I don't do accents if I can't do them right, or at least well enough. I mean, well, the rule is for accents that are specifically like not Caucasian, you know, because the stakes are much lower if a white guy from Texas is doing, you know, if he's doing a bad like British accent or whatever, you know, like that's, you just, you only look dumb. You don't necessarily look racist, you know? No. It isn't... It doesn't make me any more or less sensitive to other cultures. It's just about the outside perception. You know? There's greater stakes for getting fucking dragged if you do like, and this is like a standard opinion in like the voice acting community. If you're gonna do like, you know, like if I was gonna do like a ghetto accent, that's really fucking risky. Sakiko. It's not about the people being any different. It's about the way accents are perceived and the history behind people doing accents of, like, you know, minstrel shows are a thing, for example. That puts a whole lot more weight on when white people try to sound like black people, quote unquote. It adds a historical context that is deeply, deeply troubling. Well, there's two. I see what you're saying, and there's two aspects to that. One is that white Western people have historically been very, very bad to people that don't have white skin, and so there's that whole aspect to it. There's also the aspect that, how do I put this? Like, okay, I'm from America, and I've been around a lot of different people who have accents in America. It is far more likely that I will be able to do an accent in America with some ease. I didn't have to work too hard for most of the accents I did for Alexander Quick, for example. So I have to be a little bit less careful because it's just, I have more experience with that kind of thing. And I would go with, to a more cautious degree, and like just in terms of like not wanting to offend people who have that accent naturally, I wouldn't be worried about offending like someone from the Midwest with my Archie Green voice. I've done that voice professionally. Like I've gotten hired for jobs because of that voice. And to a slightly more cautious degree, I would also be less circumspect about doing UK accents, not just because I have experience with doing them now for a while, but I also have a somewhat extensive support structure. I have a lot of friends in England, and specifically friends that I have had conversations. In fact, the other day, when this friend of mine was helping me with Welsh, we were talking about, like, because I was like, I'm somewhat aware that there that in the past the Welsh accent has been somewhat stigmatized. And we were chatting about that some. You know, like, I have people to let me know when there is a risk to... I know that, like, Welsh people get pissed off if you do the really, really stereotypical Southern Welsh accent. I believe it's Southern Welsh accent. Or at least they get irritated because they've heard it a million times and people assume that everyone from Wales talks that way, even though there are varied accents within Wales itself. Meanwhile, I'm over here doing my damnedest just to get one of them down to any degree. But I have the ability to understand or to get people to help me understand when there is a risk much more readily with people in countries that happen to have white skin, just because those tend to be people that I know or know a lot of, because of the languages. Does that make any sense? It's a question of I know to an extent what I don't know or have a potential not to know. If it's like, okay, I can kind of bust out something of a German accent when you are holding my hand and telling me when each take sounds right. I'm that far into a German accent. I would never presume to do a German accent without that safety net. And that's also, a generally speaking, a white accent. So, like, that would be a point in your favor. I guess what I was saying more is just... America and England, I can be a little bit more lax about, because I know that either I'll know or someone I know will tell me, you know, if I'm doing something badly.
Welcome to Prince of Slytherin Recordings, ladies and gentlemen.
I guess it is less a skin color thing and more of a, like, what countries natively speak a language as their first language thing, you know? Oh, I couldn't even fucking tell you how to do a Canadian accent. I other than, like, a boot and sorry, I have no fucking clue. God, you've been typing for a long time. You're making me nervous, Akiko. You make me nervous.
Ugh.
Well, okay. It's less that I don't want to do them because I can't do them yet. It's that on the fly, if I'm recording, especially like a crack fic, you know, like when I was recording the end of Mrs. Brown's Boys, and I'm like, oh, I hit this Indian character. I know that I can't do an Indian accent yet. If I was doing this as a serious full production, what I would do is I would get with some Indian people, practice it, get it down more, and get those lines recorded. But since with a crackfic, I'm like, I'm just recording this. This is basically just for the live show, and I'll post up the rest later. I'm not going to attempt the voice because I know that I just need more work. I'm not saying I'm not willing to do that greater amount of work. I am going to do that greater amount of work. For POS, for example. I haven't done it yet, but I just haven't gotten to it yet. It's just in the moment I know what I can and can't do without sounding offensive. I know I have proof that when I try to do an Indian accent it sounds offensive. As my skills are right now. I know that for a fact.
We'll get back to it in just a second, guys.
I think this is an interesting thing to hash out, though. Yeah, it's like, and it's like, it's for like,
okay, like, here's an example. Gaming Chu's voice in Alexander Quick. I did want to give him a slight Chinese accent. And what the voice I eventually gave him was, what if Peter Baelish was American in Game of Thrones? That's the voice I went with. But I did attempt to do a Chinese accent with him. I have a cousin-in-law who is partially Chinese and does speak with an accent. I recorded him talking and tried to match his voice. I couldn't really get it done, but I felt like I had enough of a beat on it that I did record the lines. I sent them to another Chinese guy on the AQ server. I was like, "Hey, can you help me out with this?" He didn't even understand that I was trying to do a Chinese accent. That's how off it was. So I just scrapped it. I was like, this is not, I do not have the skills to do this. I will just say, okay, Gaming Chu is more assimilated into American culture than that. You know, I mean, not that he's from China, but it's like, that sort of segment of the population is a bit more, you know, it would make sense for him to have an accent given the way the AQ world works. But like, that's an example of, in a full production, I was like, I could figure this out, but I don't necessarily have the resources to do it. I couldn't find anyone willing to model the lines for me, for instance. And it's so stupid. I have a theory about this, okay? I have a fucking theory about this. I think that it is harder to do an accent for a language that you have some experience knowing how to speak or even just pronounce. And it doesn't even have to be much experience. Okay, so I can pronounce Mandarin Chinese. I took 4 semesters of it in college. I can't speak it. I would have to, like, look it up or whatever. But I do know how to fucking pronounce it. Like gangbusters. And I think that when you have expended the mental energy toward tracing the paths from the sounds that you like your mouth can natively make from your own language and turning them into the weird-ass, you know, like the different consonants and vowel sounds and stuff in Chinese, for example, I think that it's sort of like you're running a groove into the track, and it's hard to. Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah, because it's like it's interesting that I've sort of just picked, and it's like you know how good my German pronunciation is, or rather how not, you know, how mediocre it is. I think even that hurts me when I try to do a German accent, because I at least know what I'm trying to do when I pronounce German, I think. You know, there's enough in there that's juggling things up that makes it harder for me. Because I feel like the better you have the phonics for a language down, the more breadth you have in the sounds that you can make. And that gives you too many choices when you're thinking, how will I make this sound? How will I approximate this English sound with from the context of someone that doesn't natively speak the language? I don't know. Because I have trouble with Chinese accents. I have trouble with German accents. And I have trouble with Indian accents, but that's just because it's hard. You know, like sometimes the answer is just that it's hard. But yeah. I always find your viewpoint on this stuff interesting, Sakiko, because I feel like the direction that Germany comes at
this stuff is probably on the whole more enlightened than the American perspective. Because, like, with America, you have to kind of, like, resist sort of a cultural impetus to be mildly racist all the time. Because it's like, oh God, we are so fucking horrible. And it probably just leads to the terms and the ways of talking about it just being different. And, you know, if you aren't very, very specific about everything you mean, and I often am not very, very specific about what I mean, I will just say, like, white people or whatever to mean something more specific. In this case, to mean, like, cultures which historically speak English, you know, like, as their first language kind of thing. And that can sometimes lead to misunderstandings or miscommunications. Anyway. Let's get down to business to defeat the Huns. Yeah, briefly. I have people I could talk to about that. It has not been sufficiently necessary so far. I did, to an extent, in Alexandra Quick, I did at times try to make David sound like he knew what that sounded like, because he doesn't really, you know? Which I think I probably had enough context to do that, but that's not what you mean, you know? Yeah. For sure, yeah. Yeah, there are multiple people I know that I could talk to get that figured out. But, you know, yeah, it just hasn't really come up yet. Okay. Let's get back to it. It's one of the chair opposite. Okay. Ohana, this is for you.
I do apologize for my tardiness, my dear, the other woman said, but thank you so much for coming. I've been looking forward to meeting with you. Lily tried to smile, but it faltered on her lips. Your invitation was most insistent, your ladyship. Not to be rude, but why exactly have you been looking forward to meeting me?
As if the girl didn't already have a general idea. Something to do with the toe rag.
Please, Lily, said Lady Potter almost earnestly. Call me Doria. After all, I am hopeful that you and I will become great friends.
See, that is the first example of me doing slight Midlands trying to sound posh. That's Lily from Cokeworth. That's that fucking Lily.
The present. But enough about all this boring escaped Death Eater stuff, Harry said, diverting the topic. Have you seen the new Fireball yet?
Not yet.
I tried to get Mom to take me by quality Quidditch supplies on the way here, but she wouldn't go for it. There was a big crowd around the window gawking at it, and she was worried about safety. Jim frowned.
I think there's going to be a lot of that going on this year.
No, Jim, you can't do that. Safety. I mean, they haven't even decided if I can leave Hogwarts for Hogsmeade's weekends.
They haven't even decided if I can leave Hogwarts for Hogsmeade weekends this year. Will you be able to?
Harry grimaced. Don't know yet. Depends on Lily and James. The injunction against them...
The injunction against them forbids them from interfering with my education and living arrangements, but it's a Hogwarts policy that you have to have permission. The injunction against them informs... Kill me. The injunction against them forbids them from interfering with my education and living arrangements, but it's a Hogwarts policy that you have to have a permission... But it's a Hogwarts policy that you have to have a permission slip signed by a parent or guardian to visit Hogsmeade. Then again, other than Zonko's and the Quidditch supply store, there's not really that much to Hogsmeade, or so I'm told. Blaise Zabini described it as a magical hick town, and Branson, Missouri for wizards.
I have a friend who lives right next to Branson, and fucking hates it. And I showed him that bit of the fic, and he thought that was the greatest thing he'd ever heard in his fucking life.
Jim furrowed his brow. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. Harry coughed. Well, to be honest, neither do I, but it sure sounds depressing. Well, I do think we've made some pro... Yeah. Well, I do think we've made some progress today, Artie said. I don't think we're quite ready for Harry to move back to Potter Manor for good, nor even ready to dissolve the injunction, but I believe that I see the beginnings of a possible resolution of the issues between you two and your son. Perhaps we could meet up again for another such informal meeting this fall. At the Three Broomsticks during a Hogsmeade weekend, perhaps? But in light of everything that's happened, Lily replied. Lily replied, we haven't actually decided whether to sign either of the boys' We haven't actually decided whether to sign either of the boys' permission slips yet. Actually, Lily Flower, I've been giving it some thought. I've been giving it some thought, James interrupted. Something in his voice caught Lily's attention, and she stared at him as he continued. There'll be a heightened security presence in Hogsmeade this year. There will be a heightened security presence in Hogsmeade this year. And we can both make it a point to be at all the Hogsmeade weekends to act as chaperones. I really don't see why we shouldn't allow the boys to enjoy the Hogsmeade experience, do you? Lily crooked an eyebrow. They had discussed the matter just the night before, and it had been James who'd voiced the loudest objections. Objections he now seemed to have abandoned. James tried unsuccessfully to stand up to his wife's gaze before turning away and coughing softly with an oddly embarrassed look on his face. Lily said nothing but simply studied her husband's face while looking for his usual tells, most of which now seemed to say, "There's something stupid I've done that I'm ashamed to..." "There's something stupid I've done that I'm ashamed to tell you about."
Finish the chapter, yes.
1 hour earlier, just as the morning's Wizengamot session ended.
"Ah, James," said Cornelius Fudge in a surprisingly upbeat voice. "Well done so far, I think. The morning session went as well as it possibly could have."
Potter agreed.
"Yes, a lot of the peers are frightened, but they're not panicking yet. Hopefully that attitude will continue this afternoon once we're discussing solutions instead of just defining the problem."
He turned and looked up towards the galley.
"I say, is that Jim sitting with Draco Malfoy? I hadn't thought them likely to form a friendship."
James followed the minister's gaze and frowned.
"That's my other son, Harry. He's in Slytherin." "Ah, of course. So is young Jim. I'd have to speak with him and reassure him that we were doing all we could for his defense."
"He's at home right now. Lily and I wanted to see how the new security arrangements were working before..." Lily and I wanted to see how the new security arrangements were working out before we let him come to the ministry.
"A sensible precaution, I suppose.
Here in the heart of downtown London, the Ministry secure. Yeah. Here in the heart of downtown London, the Ministry. Shit, fuck me. Here in the heart of downtown London, the Ministry security is still questionable. Still, perhaps I'll get to see him at Hogsmeade this year?
James hesitated as he wondered why the Minister of Magic.
No, he's not the Minister of Magic.
James hesitated as he wondered why the Minister for Magic was so eager to see Jim. Then he realized Fudge was more interested in being seen with Jim than in just seeing him.
To be honest, Cornelius, Lily and I haven't decided yet about that.
Cornelius leaned in closer to Potter. James, he said in a softer but more urgent voice,
it is very important that we do everything we can to prevent public panic at this moment. Most of the nation looks up to Jim as an icon. I presume that we'll provide whatever security is needed, but if Jim is afraid to go to Hogsmeade, his peers will be too afraid as well, and that fear will only spread.
He took a step closer.
These times call for a firm and resolute response. Don't you agree, Chief Oro?
James couldn't help but notice the subtle emphasis Fudge placed on the title of Chief Auror, a position to which he'd risen at an impossibly young age thanks to Fudge's patronage, and also a position in which he served at the pleasure of the minister.
You raise valid points, Minister Fudge. I will certainly take them under consideration, James said diplomatically. See that you do, Chief Oro. I'm sure you'll come to the right decision.
With that, Fudge warmly squeezed James's shoulder before turning away to talk to some other officials. James exhaled slowly as he considered his boss's words. And for the first time since accepting his position, he noticed the sensation of chains constricting all around him.
One section left. Who is pinging me and why? Okay, I'm killing it. I'm pings on that server. Holy fuck. All right.
Okay, here we go. Last bit. A supply closet on the third floor of the Ministry of Magic. 1:30 p.m. Rita Skeeter was one of the most famous and notorious gossip columnists of her time, with a unique image known to every wizard and witch in Britain who had ever set foot in a bookstore or perused the gossip pages of the Daily Prophet. With her platinum blonde hair, stylish, if somewhat over-applied, makeup, ultra-chic clothes from the best shops, and, of course, her famous jewel-encrusted spectacles, practically everyone knew what Rita Skeeter looked like. What few people knew, however, was that Rita Skeeter was just a pen name. Every good reporter knows that there are times to make an impression and times that call for discretion. And when Rita wanted to be discreet, a discreet human anyway, she simply changed her clothes, scrumped off her makeup, ditched the spectacles, which were purely for show anyway, and cancelled the spell that turned her normal mousy brown hair into platinum blonde curls. Rita Skeeter disappeared, and bland, unassuming Marguerite Scarabee, Ravenclaw, class of 1978, took her place. It wasn't that often, because Marguerite Scarabee loved being Rita Skeeter, but unfortunately some of her contacts, in fact most of her better contacts, preferred not to meet with her when she wore such an infamous mask. Indeed, her very best contact was quite adamant about the matter. Which explained how the plainly dressed and which explained how the plainly dressed and utterly forgettable Marguerite Scarabee found herself in a storage closet on the third floor of the Ministry of Magic, eating scones and drinking warmish tea with Eleanor Burke, personal secretary to Chief Auror James Potter.
"So they really don't have any clue who's responsible?" Marguerite asked.
She did not take notes, as Eleanor was insistent that there be no easily verifiable record of their conversations.
I didn't really mention anything about her changing her voice. You probably would, but I enjoy the Rita Skeeter voice too much not to do it.
"So they really didn't have any clue who's responsible?" Marguerite asked.
She did not take notes, as Eleanor was insistent that there be no easily verifiable record of their conversations, a sensible precaution in light of the quality of secrets the old witch regularly provided.
"Not a clue," Eleanor said. "The blackboard in Potter's conference room has 27 names of suspects on it, all of them completely speculative."
The old witch reached into a pocket and produced a parchment upon which the 27 suspects were written in block printing that left neither a magical signature nor a recognizable handwriting that could be traced to her.
"Of course, I've got my own theories, but Chief Potter hasn't asked me for anything more than to fetch the tea."
"Who do you think was behind it?" Eleanor took a sip of tea.
"I have no proof of anything, but I'm leaning towards Tiberius Nod."
Marguerite was surprised.
"Why him?" "You recall last summer, when someone sent the boy who lived a cursed choo-choo train for his birthday that nearly killed him?"
The reporter nodded.
"That train was one of Erasmus Wilkes' little projects, which means that someone has taken an interest. Yeah. Which means that someone has taken an interest in the toymaker's work. And by an interesting coincidence, they're a test marker over in records."
Fuck you, TSM.
"Vera Tesmacher over in records told me that Lord Knott has quietly filed a sealed marriage contract with Wilkes's only surviving family, his daughter, Amelia or Amantha or something like that. There's got to be some connection there. And anyway, to take the extreme step of marrying someone so young, he must think that doing so will get power over the Wilkes estate. I'll wager he knows where a fortune in galleons is hidden, maybe even a mega fortune in purified orichalcum, plus Merlin knows what sort of dark objects. Wilkes was known for that, and if Nod is after it, he may have believed that you know whose inner circle had useful information. Maybe it's because I'm Slytherin, but I can't imagine any reason to risk breaking into Azkaban unless there's a lot of money involved. How old is the Wilkes girl?"
"Oh, 12 or so, I should think."
"Yeah, go ahead. Fucking test marker."
Marguerite nearly choked on her tea.
12? That's obscene. How is that remotely legal?
Eleanor shrugged diffidently. He can officially marry her at that age, and thereby gain legal authority over their affairs and whatever is left of the...
He can officially marry her at that age, and thereby gain legal authority over her affairs and whatever is left of the Wilkes estate, which is what I assume he's after.
Then she noticed Marguerite's horrified expression.
"And don't be so squeamish, dear. Arranged marriages, even with startling age... Arranged marriages, even with startling age differences, have a storied history in the Wizarding World. We live for so long that age gaps of 20 or 30 years used to be perfectly normal before all the mudbloods started whinging about civil rights for minors and other nonsense. So long as he waits until the girl is older to consummate the marriage, assuming he even wants to, I see nothing wrong. I see nothing wrong with Tiberius Nod taking a young girl under his sheltering wing."
Marguerite said nothing. Given what she knew of Tiberius, I swear I was under the imperious not. She thought there were all sorts of things wrong with him sheltering a young girl under his wing. She resolved to look into the proposed not Wilkes nuptials to see if there might be a story to be made out of that sordid affair,
one that was both profitable to pursue and not likely to result in her tragic and unlamented demise. Death Eaters got so touchy. Death Eaters got so touchy when one questioned their moral character, after all. For the same reason, she ignored Eleanor Burke's overt bigotry. To be honest, whether she was Rita Skeeter or Marguerite Scarabee, she sometimes felt that she preferred... She sometimes felt that she preferred to deal blood purists and... She sometimes felt that she preferred to deal with blood purists and other bigots. There was much less chance of her actually developing feelings of friendship with her contacts that might complicate things. Dumbledore shut not down at one point, as I recall, she said. Some comment about how we shouldn't judge someone by their relatives that really struck home. Eleanor nodded sagely. Nott's father was a Grindelwald supporter. He had enough money and influence to cover it up, but it was an open secret back in the 40s. If the elder Nott had been anything less than a lord of an ancient and noble house, he'd have died in Azkaban. But then, the Notts have always been... But then, the Notts have always been notoriously vile going back centuries. But then, the Notts have always been notoriously vile going back generations. They were very into muggle hunting back when it was legal. If the little no-name boy had any sense, he'd have left the country already and counted himself lucky to be free of that shabby lot. Rita absorbed that. She'd also wondered if there was a story to be had in the tale of Theo No-Name, and if so, was the boy a hero, a victim, or a villain? Best hold off on that, she thought to herself, until I find out exactly how that ultimate sanction nonsense affects the majority of my readers. Until I find out how exactly that ultimate sanction nonsense affects the majority of my readers. Okay, that's enough about the Nots, she said. What can you tell me about Fudge's new undersecretary? Not much beyond her job description and portfolio. She's Fudge's new advisor on matters pertaining to the Ministry's magical treaty obligations in general, and on Hogwarts in particular. Apparently, Cornelius's admiration for Dumbledore has begun to cool lately, but I don't know how much... But I don't know much about the woman in particular, which I find personally vexing, but that appears to be because she's spent the last 15 years floundering in obscurity rather than actual discretion on her part. If you want me to, I'll make inquiries. Naturally, gossip and innuendo cost extra. Of course, the reporter said as she pulled a small bag of galleons from her robe and handed it over to her informant. I think I'm familiar with your rates by now. End of chapter 9.